Ethereal shape was that which he had spent his life escaping, a commitment. He had not decided to resign. Not really, he thought. He had dictated the letter for a motive which he identified to himself only as just in case. The letter, he felt, was a form of protection. But he had not signed it yet, and that was his protection against the protection. The hatred was directed at whatever had brought him to feel that he would not be able to continue extending this process much longer. He had received word of the catastrophe at 8 o'clock this morning. By noon, he had arrived at his office. An instinct that came from reasons which he knew, but spent his whole effort on not knowing, had told him that he had to be there this time. The men who had been his marked card, in a game he knew how to play, were gone. Clifton Losey was barricaded behind the statement of a doctor who had announced that Mr. Losey was suffering from a heart condition which made it impossible to disturb him at present. One of Taggart's executive assistants was said to have left for Boston last night, and the other was said to have been called unexpectedly to an unnamed hospital, to the bedside of a father nobody had ever suspected him of having. There was no answer at the home of the chief engineer. The vice president in charge of public relations could not be found. Driving through the streets to his office, Taggart had seen the black letters of the headlines. Walking down the corridors of Taggart Transcontinental, he had heard the voice of a speaker pouring from a radio in someone's office, the kind of voice one expects to hear on unlighted street corners. It was screaming demands for the nationalization of the railroads. He had walked through the corridors, his steps noisy in order to be seen, and hasty in order not to be stopped for questions. He had locked the door of his office, ordering his secretary not to admit any person or phone call, and to tell all comers that Mr. Taggart was busy. Then he sat at his desk, alone with blank terror. He felt as if he were trapped in a subterranean vault and the lock could never be broken again, and as if he were held on display in the sight of the whole city below, hoping that the lock would hold out for eternity. He had to be here, in this office. It was required of him. He had to sit idly and wait. Wait for the unknown to descend upon him and to determine his actions. And the terror was both of who would come for him and of the fact that nobody came, nobody to tell him what to do. The ringing of the telephones in the outer office sounded like screams for help. He looked at the door with a sensation of malevolent triumph at the thought of all those voices being defeated by the innocuous figure of his secretary, a young man expert at nothing but the art of evasion, which he practiced with the gray rubber limpness of the amoral. The voices, thought Taggart, were coming from Colorado, from every center of the Taggart system, from every office of the building around him. He was safe, so long as he did not have to hear them. His emotions had clogged into a still, solid, opaque ball within him, which the thought of the men who operated the Taggart system could not pierce. Those men were merely enemies to be outwitted. The sharper bites of fear came from the thought of the men on the board of directors. But his letter of resignation was his fire escape, which would leave them stuck with the fire. The sharpest fear came from the thought of the men in Washington. If they called, he would have to answer. His rubber secretary would know whose voices superseded his orders. But Washington did not call. The fear went through him in spasms once in a while, leaving his mouth dry. He did not know what he dreaded. He knew that it was not the threat of the radio speaker. What he had experienced at the sound of the snarling voice had been more like a terror which he felt because he was expected to feel it, a duty terror, something that went with his position, like well-tailored suits and luncheon speeches. But under it, he had felt a sneaking little hope, swift and furtive like the course of a cockroach. If that threat took form, it would solve everything, save him from decision, save him from signing the letter. He would not be president of Taggart Transcontinental any longer, but neither would anyone else. Neither would anyone else. He sat, looking down at his desk, keeping his eyes and his mind out of focus. It was as if he were immersed in a pool of fog, struggling not to let it reach the finality of any form. That which exists possesses identity. He could keep it out of existence by refusing to identify it. He did not examine the events in Colorado. He did not attempt to grasp their cause. He did not consider their consequences. He did not think. The clogged ball of emotion was like a physical weight in his chest, filling his consciousness, releasing him from the responsibility of thought. The ball was hatred. Hatred as his only answer. Hatred as the sole reality. Hatred without object, cause, beginning, or end. Hatred as his claim against the universe, as a justification, as a right, as an absolute. The screaming of the telephones went on through the silence. He knew that those pleas for help were not addressed to him, but to an entity whose shape he had stolen. It was this shape that the screams were now tearing away from him. He felt as if the ringing ceased to be sounds and became a succession of slashes hitting his skull. The object of the hatred began to take form, as if summoned by the bells. The solid ball exploded within him and flung him blindly into action. Rushing out of the room, in defiance of all the faces around him, he went running down the halls to the operating department and into the anteroom of the operating vice president's office. The door to the office was open. He saw the sky in the great windows beyond an empty desk. Then he saw the staff in the anteroom around him and the blonde head of Eddie Willers in the glass cubbyhole. He walked purposefully straight toward Eddie Willers. He flung the glass door open, and from the threshold, in the sight and hearing of the room, he screamed, "Where is she?" Eddie Willers rose slowly to his feet and stood looking at Taggart with an odd kind of dutiful curiosity, as if this were one more phenomenon to observe among all the unprecedented things he had observed. He did not answer. "Where is she?" "I cannot tell you." "Listen, you stubborn little punk. This is no time for ceremony. If you're trying to make me believe that you don't know where she is, I don't believe you. You know it, and you're going to tell me, or I'll report you to the Unification Board. I'll swear to them that you know it. Then try and prove that you don't." There was a faint tone of astonishment in Eddie's voice as he answered, "I've never attempted to imply that I don't know where she is, Jim. I know it. But I won't tell you." Taggart's scream rose to the shrill, impotent sound that confesses a miscalculation. "Do you realize what you're saying?" "Why, yes, of course." "Will you repeat it?" He waved at the room. "For these witnesses." Eddie raised his voice a little, more in precision and clarity than in volume. "I know where she is, but I will not tell you." "You're confessing that you're an accomplice who's aiding and abetting a deserter?"
"If that's what you wish to call it."
"But it's a crime. It's a crime against the nation. Don't you know that?"
"No."
"It's against the law."
"Yes."
"This is a national emergency. You have no right to any private secrets. You're withholding vital information. I'm the president of this railroad. I'm ordering you to tell me. You can't refuse to obey an order. It's a penitentiary offense. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Do you refuse?"
"I do."
Years of training had made Taggart able to watch any audience around him without appearing to do so. He saw the tight, closed faces of the staff, faces that were not his allies. All had a look of despair, except the face of Eddie Willers.
The feudal serf of Taggart Transcontinental was the only one who seemed untouched by the disaster. He looked at Taggart with the lifelessly conscientious glance of a scholar confronted by a field of knowledge he had never wanted to study.
"Do you realize that you're a traitor?"
yelled Taggart. Eddie asked quietly, "To whom?"
"To the people. It's treason to shield a deserter. It's economic treason. Your duty to feed the people comes first, above anything else whatever. Every public authority has said so. Don't you know it? Don't you know what they'll do to you?"
"Don't you see that I don't give a damn about that?" "Oh, you don't? I'll quote that to the Unification Board. I have all these witnesses to prove that you said—"
"Don't bother about witnesses, Jim. Don't put them on the spot. I'll write down everything I said. I'll sign it, and you can take it to the board."
The sudden explosion of Taggart's voice sounded as if he had been slapped.
"Who are you to stand against the government? Who are you, you miserable little office rat, to judge national policies and hold opinions of your own? Do you think the country has time to bother about your opinions, your wishes, or your precious little conscience? You're going to learn a lesson, all of you. All of you spoiled, self-indulgent, undisciplined little two-bit clerks who strut as if that crap about your rights was serious. You're going to learn that these are not the days of Nat Taggart."
Eddie said nothing. For an instant they stood looking at each other across the desk. Taggart's face was distorted by terror. Eddie's remained sternly serene. James Taggart believed the existence of an Eddie Willers too well. Eddie Willers could not believe the existence of a James Taggart.
"Do you think the nation will bother about your wishes or hers?" screamed Taggart. "It's her duty to come back. It's her duty to work. What do we care whether she wants to work or not? We need her."
"Do you, Jim?"
An impulse pertaining to self-preservation made Taggart back a step away from the sound of that particular tone, a very quiet tone in the voice of Eddie Willers. But Eddie made no move to follow. He remained standing behind his desk, in a manner suggesting the civilized tradition of a business office.
"You won't find her," he said. "She won't be back."
"I'm glad she won't. You can starve. You can close the railroad. You can throw me in jail. You can have me shot.
What does it matter?
I won't tell you where she is. If I see the whole country crashing, I won't tell you. You won't find her. You—" They whirled at the sound of the entrance door flung open. They saw Dagny standing on the threshold. She wore a wrinkled cotton dress, and her hair was disheveled by hours of driving. She stopped for the duration of a glance around her, as if to recapture the place, but there was no recognition of persons in her eyes. The glance merely swept through the room, as if making a swift inventory of physical objects. Her face was not the face they remembered. It had aged, not by means of lines, but by means of a still, naked look stripped of any quality save ruthlessness. Yet their first response, ahead of shock or wonder, was a single emotion that went through the room like a gasp of relief. It was in all their faces but one. Eddie Willers, who alone had been calm a moment ago, collapsed with his face down on his desk. He made no sound, but the movements of his shoulders were sobs. Her face gave no sign of acknowledgement to anyone, no greeting, as if her presence here were inevitable and no words were necessary. She went straight to the door of her office. Passing the desk of her secretary, she said, her voice like the sound of a business machine, neither rude nor gentle, "Ask Eddie to come in." James Taggart was the first one to move, as if dreading to let her out of his sight. He rushed in after her. He cried, "I couldn't help it!" And then, life returning to him, his own, his normal kind of life, he screamed, "It was your fault.
You did it. You're to blame for it. Because you left.
He wondered whether his scream had been an illusion inside his own ears. Her face remained blank. Yet she had turned to him. She looked as if sounds had reached her, but not words, not the communication of a mind. What he felt for a moment was his closest approach to a sense of his own non-existence. Then he saw the faintest change in her face, merely the indication of perceiving a human presence. But she was looking past him, and he turned and saw that Eddie Willers had entered the office. There were traces of tears in Eddie's eyes, but he made no attempt to hide them. He stood straight, as if the tears or any embarrassment or any apology for them were as irrelevant to him as to her. She said, "Get Ryan on the telephone. Tell him I'm here. Then let me speak to him." Ryan had been the general manager of the railroad's central region. Eddie gave her a warning by not answering at once, then said, his voice as even as hers, "Ryan's gone, Dagny. He quit last week." They did not notice Taggart, as they did not notice the furniture around them. She had not granted him even the recognition of ordering him out of her office. Like a paralytic, uncertain of his muscles' obedience, he gathered his strength and slipped out. But he was certain of the first thing he had to do. He hurried to his office to destroy his letter of resignation. She did not notice his exit. She was looking at Eddie. "Is Noland here?" she asked. "No. He's gone."
"Andrews?"
"Gone."
"McGuire?"
"Gone." He went on quietly to recite the list of those he knew she would ask for, those most needed in this hour, who had resigned and vanished within the past month. She listened without astonishment or emotion, as one listens to the casualty list of a battle where all are doomed, and it makes no difference whose names fall first. When he finished, she made no comment, but asked,
"What has been done since this morning?"
"Nothing."
"Nothing?"
"Dagny, any office boy could have issued orders here since this morning, and everybody would have obeyed him. But even the office boys know that whoever makes the first move today will be held responsible for the future, the present, and the past, when the buck passing begins. He would not save the system. He would merely lose his job by the time he saved one division.
Nothing has been done.
It's stopped still. Whatever is moving on anyone's blind guess, out on the line where they don't know whether they're to move or to stop. Some trains are held at stations. Others are going on, waiting to be stopped before they reach Colorado. It's whatever the local dispatchers decide. The terminal manager downstairs has canceled all transcontinental traffic for today, including tonight's Comet. I don't know what the manager in San Francisco is doing. Only the wrecking crews are working. At the tunnel. They haven't come anywhere near the wreck as yet. I don't think they will. Phone the terminal manager downstairs and tell him to put all transcontinental trains back on the schedule at once, including tonight's Comet. Then come back here." When he came back, she was bending over the map she had spread on a table, and she spoke while he made rapid notes. "Route all westbound trains south from Kirby, Nebraska, down the spur track to Hastings, down the track of the Kansas Western to Laurel, Kansas, then to the track of the Atlantic Southern at Jasper, Oklahoma. West on the Atlantic Southern to Flagstaff, Arizona, north on the track of the Flagstaff Homedale to Elgin, Utah, north to Midland, northwest on the track of the Wasatch Railway to Salt Lake City. The Wasatch Railway is an abandoned narrow gauge. Buy it. Have the gauge spread to standard. If the owners are afraid, since sales are illegal, pay them twice the money and proceed with the work. There is no rail between Laurel, Kansas and Jasper, Oklahoma. 3 miles. No rail between Elgin and Midland, Utah. 5.5 miles. Have the rail laid. Have construction crews start at once. Recruit every local man available. Pay twice the legal wages, 3 times, anything they ask. Put 3 shifts on, and have the job done overnight. For rail, tear up the sidings at Winston, Colorado, at Silver Springs, Colorado, at Leeds, Utah, at Benson, Nevada.
If any local stooges of the Unification Board come to stop the work, give authority to our local men, the ones you trust, to bribe them. Don't put that through the accounting department. Charge it to me. I'll pay it. If they find some case where it doesn't work, have them tell the stooge that Directive 10-289 does not provide for local injunctions, that an injunction has to be brought against our headquarters, and that they have to sue me if they wish to stop us. Is that true?
How do I know? How can anybody know?
But by the time they untangle it and decide whatever it is they please to decide, our track will be built.
I see. I'll go over the lists and give you the names of our local men to put in charge, if they're still there. By the time tonight's comet reaches Kirby, Nebraska, the track will be ready. It will add about 36 hours to the transcontinental schedule, but there will be a transcontinental schedule. Then have them get for me out of the files the old maps of our road as it was before Nat Taggart's grandson built the tunnel.
The... what?
He did not raise his voice, but the catch of his breath was the break of emotion he had wanted to avoid. Her face did not change, but a faint note in her voice acknowledged him, a note of gentleness, not reproof. The old maps of the days before the tunnel. We're going back, Eddie. Let's hope we can. No, we won't rebuild the tunnel. There's no way to do it now. But the old grade that crossed the Rockies is still there. It can be reclaimed. Only it will be hard to get the rail for it and the men to do it. Particularly the men. He knew, as he had known from the first, that she had seen his tears and that she had not walked past in indifference, even though her clear, toneless voice and unmoving face gave him no sign of feeling. There was some quality in her manner which he sensed but could not translate. Yet the feeling it gave him, translated, was as if she were saying to him, "I know. I understand. I would feel compassion and gratitude if we were alive and free to feel, but we're not, are we, Eddie? We're on a dead planet like the moon, where we must move, but dare not stop for a breath of feeling, or we'll discover that there is no air to breathe." "We have today and tomorrow to get things started," she said. "I'll leave for Colorado tomorrow night." "If you want to fly, I'll have to rent a plane for you somewhere. Yours is still in the shops. They can't get the parts for it."
"No, I'll go by rail. I have to see the line. I'll take tomorrow's comet."
It was 2 hours later, in a brief pause between long-distance phone calls, that she asked him suddenly the first question which did not pertain to the railroad.
"What have they done to Hank Reardon?"
Eddie caught himself in the small evasion of looking away, forced his glance back to meet hers, and answered,
"He gave in.
He signed their gift certificate. At the last moment."
"Oh."
The sound conveyed no shock or censure. It was merely a vocal punctuation mark, denoting the acceptance of a fact.
"Have you heard from Quentin Daniels?"
"No."
"He sent no letter or message for me?"
"No." He guessed the thing she feared, and it reminded him of a matter he had not reported. "Dagny, there's another problem that's been growing all over the system since you left. Since May 1st. It's the frozen trains."
"The what?"
"We've had trains abandoned on the line, on some passing track in the middle of nowhere, usually at night, with the entire crew gone. They just leave the train and vanish. There's never any warning given or any special reason. It's more like an epidemic. It hits the men suddenly and they go. It's been happening on other railroads, too. Nobody can explain it. But I think that everybody understands. It's the directive that's doing it. It's our men's form of protest. They try to go on, and then they suddenly reach a moment when they can't take it any longer."
"What can we do about it?"
He shrugged.
"Oh, well.
Who is John Galt?" She nodded thoughtfully. She did not look astonished. The telephone rang, and the voice of her secretary said,
Mr. Wesley Mouch calling from Washington, Miss Taggart?"
Her lips stiffened a little, as at the unexpected touch of an insect.
"It must be for my brother," she said. "No, Miss Taggart, for you." "All right, put him on."
"Miss Taggart," said the voice of Wesley Mouch in the tone of a cocktail party host, "I was so glad to hear you've regained your health that I wanted to welcome you back in person. I know that your health required a long rest, and I appreciate the patriotism that made you cut your leave of absence short in this terrible emergency. I wanted to assure you that you can count on our cooperation in any step you now find it necessary to take. Our fullest cooperation, assistance, and support. If there are any special exceptions you might require, please feel certain that they can be granted." She let him speak, even though he had made several small pauses inviting an answer. When his pause became long enough, she said,
"I would be much obliged if you would let me speak to Mr. Weatherby."
"Why, of course, Miss Taggart. Any time you wish." "Why, that is, do you mean now?"
"Yes, right now."
He understood, but he said, "Yes, Miss Taggart." When Mr. Weatherby's voice came on the wire, it sounded cautious.
"Yes, Miss Taggart? Of what service can I be to you?"
"You can tell your boss that if he doesn't want me to quit again, as he knows I did, he is never to call me or speak to me. Anything your gang has to tell me, let them send you to tell it. I'll speak to you, but not to him. You may tell him that my reason is what he did to Hank Reardon when he was on Reardon's payroll. If everybody else has forgotten it, I haven't."
"It is my duty to assist the nation's railroads at any time, Miss Taggart." Mr. Weatherby sounded as if he were trying to avoid the commitment of having heard what he had heard, but a sudden note of interest crept into his voice as he asked slowly, thoughtfully, with guarded shrewdness,
"Am I to understand, Miss Taggart, that it is your wish to deal exclusively with me in all official matters? May I take this as your policy?"
She gave a brief, harsh chuckle.
"Go ahead," she said. "You may list me as your exclusive property, use me as a special item of pull, and trade me all over Washington. But I don't know what good that will do you, because I'm not going to play the game. I'm not going to trade favors. I'm simply going to start breaking your laws right now. And you can arrest me when you feel that you can afford to."
"I believe that you have an old-fashioned idea about law, Miss Taggart. Why speak of rigid, unbreakable laws? Our modern laws are elastic and open to interpretation according to circumstances."
"Then start being elastic right now, because I'm not, and neither are railroad catastrophes."
She hung up and said to Eddie, in the tone of an estimate passed on physical objects,
"They'll leave us alone for a while."
She did not seem to notice the changes in her office. The absence of Nat Taggart's portrait, the new glass coffee table where Mr. Losey had spread, for the benefit of visitors, a display of the loudest humanitarian magazines with titles of articles headlined on their covers. She heard, with the attentive look of a machine equipped to record, not to react, Eddie's account of what 1 month had done to the railroad. She heard his report on what he guessed about the causes of the catastrophe. She faced, with the same look of detachment, a succession of men who went in and out of her office with overhurried steps and hands fumbling in superfluous gestures. He thought that she had become impervious to anything. But suddenly, while pacing the office, dictating to him a list of track-laying materials and where to obtain them illegally, she stopped and looked down at the magazines on the coffee table. Their headlines said, "The New Social Conscience, Our Duty to the Underprivileged, Need versus Greed." With a single movement of her arm, the abrupt, explosive movement of sheer physical brutality, such as he had never seen from her before, she swept the magazines off the table and went on, her voice reciting a list of figures without a break, as if there were no connection between her mind and the violence of her body. Late in the afternoon, finding a moment alone in her office, she telephoned Hank Reardon. She gave her name to his secretary, and she heard, in the way he said it, the haste with which he had seized the receiver.
Dagny.
Hello, Hank. I'm back.
Where?
In my office.
She heard the things he did not say, in the moment's silence on the wire. Then he said,
I suppose I'd better start bribing people at once to get the ore to start pouring rail for you.
Yes. As much of it as you can. It doesn't have to be Reardon metal. It can be...
The break in her voice was almost too brief to notice, but what it held was the thought,
Reardon metal rail, for going back to the time before heavy steel? Perhaps back to the time of wooden rails with strips of iron? It can be steel. Any weight. Anything you can give me.
All right. Dagny, do you know that I've surrendered Reardon metal to them? I've signed the gift certificate.
Yes, I know.
I've given in.
Who am I to blame you? Haven't I?
He did not answer, and she said,
Hank, I don't think they care whether there's a train or a blast furnace left on Earth. We do. They're holding us by our love of it, and we'll go on paying so long as there's still one chance left to keep one single wheel alive and moving in token of human intelligence. We'll go on holding it afloat, like our drowning child, and when the flood swallows it, we'll go down with the last wheel and the last syllogism. I know what we're paying, but price is no object any longer.
I know.
Don't be afraid for me, Hank. I'll be all right by tomorrow morning.
I'll never be afraid for you, darling. I'll see you tonight.
Chapter 9. The Face Without Pain or Fear or Guilt. The silence of her apartment and the motionless perfection of objects that had remained just as she had left them a month before struck her with a sense of relief and desolation together when she entered her living room. The silence gave her an illusion of privacy and ownership. The sight of the objects reminded her that they were preserving a moment she could not recapture, as she could not undo the events that had happened since. There was still a remnant of daylight beyond the windows. She had left the office earlier than she intended, unable to summon the effort for any task that could be postponed till morning. This was new to her, and it was new that she should now feel more at home in her apartment than in her office. She took a shower and stood for long, blank minutes, letting the water run over her body, but stepped out hastily when she realized that what she wanted to wash off was not the dust of the drive from the country, but the feel of the office. She dressed, lighted a cigarette, and walked into the living room to stand at the window, looking at the city, as she had stood looking at the countryside at the start of this day. She had said she would give her life for one more year on the railroad. She was back. But this was not the joy of working. It was only the clear, cold peace of a decision reached, and the stillness of unadmitted pain. Clouds had wrapped the sky and had descended as fog to wrap the streets below, as if the sky were engulfing the city. She could see the whole of Manhattan Island, a long triangular shape cutting into an invisible ocean. It looked like the prow of a sinking ship. A few tall buildings still rose above it like funnels, but the rest was disappearing under gray-blue coils, going down slowly into vapor and space. This was how they had gone, she thought. Atlantis, the city that sank into the ocean, and all the other kingdoms that vanished, leaving the same legend in all the languages of men, and the same longing. She felt,
as she had felt it one spring night, slumped across her desk in the crumbling office of the Jungalt line, by a window facing a dark alley, the sense and vision of her own world, which she would never reach.
"You,"
she thought,
"whoever you are,
whom I have always loved and never found, you whom I expected to see at the end of the rails beyond the horizon, you whose presence I had always felt in the streets of the city, and whose world I had wanted to build. It is my love for you that had kept me moving, my love and my hope to reach you, and my wish to be worthy of you on the day when I would stand before you face to face. Now I know that I shall never find you, that it is not to be reached or lived. But what is left of my life is still yours, and I will go on in your name, even though it is a name I'll never learn. I will go on serving you, even though I'm never to win. I will go on to be worthy of you on the day when I would have met you, even though I won't." She had never accepted hopelessness, but she stood at the window and, addressed to the shape of a fog-bound city, it was her self-dedication to unrequited love. The doorbell rang. She turned with indifferent astonishment to open the door, but she knew that she should have expected him when she saw that it was Francisco D'Anconia. She felt no shock and no rebellion, only the cheerless serenity of her assurance, and she raised her head to face him with a slow, deliberate movement, as if telling him that she had chosen her stand and that she stood in the open. His face was grave and calm. The look of happiness was gone, but the amusement of the playboy had not returned. He looked as if all masks were down. He looked direct, tightly disciplined, intent upon a purpose. He looked like a man able to know the earnestness of action, as she had once expected him to look. He had never seemed so attractive as he did in this moment, and she noted, in astonishment, her sudden feeling that he was not a man who had deserted her, but a man whom she had deserted. "Dagny, are you able to talk about it now?"
"Yes, if you wish. Come in."
He glanced briefly at her living room, her home which he had never entered, then his eyes came back to her. He was watching her attentively. He seemed to know that the quiet simplicity of her manner was the worst of all signs for his purpose, that it was like a spread of ashes where no flicker of pain could be revived, that even pain would have been a form of fire.
"Sit down, Francisco."
She remained standing before him, as if consciously letting him see that she had nothing to hide, not even the weariness of her posture, the price she had paid for this day, and her carelessness of price.
"I don't think I can stop you now," he said, "if you've made your choice. But if there's one chance left to stop you, it's a chance I have to take."
She shook her head slowly.
"There isn't. And what for, Francisco? You've given up. What difference does it make to you whether I perish with the railroad or away from it?"
"I haven't given up the future."
"What future?"
"The day when the looters will perish, but we won't." "If Taggart Transcontinental is to perish with the looters, then so am I." He did not take his eyes off her face, and he did not answer. She added dispassionately,
"I thought I could live without it. I can't.
I'll never try it again.
Francisco, do you remember? We both believed, when we started, that the only sin on earth was to do things badly. I still believe it."
The first note of life shuddered in her voice.
"I can't stand by and watch what they did at that tunnel. I can't accept what they're all accepting. Francisco, it's the thing we thought so monstrous, you and I. The belief that disasters are one's natural fate, to be born, not fought. I can't accept submission. I can't accept helplessness. I can't accept renunciation. So long as there's a railroad left to run, I'll run it.
In order to maintain the looter's world,
in order to maintain the last strip of mine,
Dagny, he said slowly, I know why one loves one's work. I know what it means to you, the job of running trains. But you would not run them if they were empty. Dagny, what is it you see when you think of a moving train? She glanced at the city. The life of a man of ability who might have perished in that catastrophe, but will escape the next one, which I'll prevent. A man who has an intransigent mind and an unlimited ambition, and is in love with his own life. The kind of man who is what we were when we started, you and I. You gave him up. I can't. He closed his eyes for an instant, and the tightening movement of his mouth was a smile. A smile substituting for a moan of understanding, amusement, and pain. He asked, his voice gravely gentle, Do you think that you can still serve him, that kind of man, by running the railroad?
Yes.
All right, Dagny. I won't try to stop you. So long as you still think that, nothing can stop you or should. You will stop on the day when you'll discover that your work has been placed in the service, not of that man's life, but of his destruction.
Francisco!
It was a cry of astonishment and despair. You do understand it. You know what I mean by that kind of man. You see him too. Oh, yes, he said simply, casually, looking at some point in space within the room, almost as if he were seeing a real person. He added, Why should you be astonished? You said that we were of his kind once, you and I. We still are. But one of us has betrayed him. Yes, she said sternly, one of us has. We cannot serve him by renunciation. We cannot serve him by making terms with his destroyers. I'm not making terms with them. They need me. They know it. It's my terms that I'll make them accept. By playing a game in which they gain benefits in exchange for harming you. If I can keep Taggart Transcontinental in existence, it's the only benefit I want. What do I care if they make me pay ransoms? Let them have what they want. I'll have the railroad. He smiled. Do you think so? Do you think that their need of you is your protection? Do you think that you can give them what they want? No. You won't quit until you see, of your own sight and judgment, what it is that they really want. You know, Dagny, we were taught that some things belong to God and others to Caesar. Perhaps their God would permit it. But the man you say we're serving, he does not permit it. He permits no divided allegiance, no war between your mind and your body, no gulf between your values and your actions, no tributes to Caesar. He permits no Caesars. For 12 years, she said softly, I would have thought it inconceivable that there might come a day when I would have to beg your forgiveness on my knees. Now I think it's possible. If I come to see that you're right, I will. But not until then. You will. But not on your knees. He was looking at her, as if he were seeing her body as she stood before him, even though his eyes were directed at her face, and his glance told her what form of atonement and surrender he was seeing in the future. She saw the effort he made to look away, his hope that she had not seen his glance or understood it, his silent struggle, betrayed by the tension of a few muscles under the skin of his face, the face she knew so well. Until then, Dagny, remember that we're enemies. I don't want to tell you this, but you're the first person who almost stepped into heaven and came back to earth. You've glimpsed too much. So, you have to know this clearly. It's you that I'm fighting, not your brother James or Wesley Mouch. It's you that I have to defeat. I am out to end all the things that are most precious to you right now.
While you'll struggle to save Taggart Transcontinental, I will be working to destroy it. Don't ever ask me for help or money. You know my reasons. Now you may hate me, as, from your stand, you should.
She raised her head a little. There was no perceptible change in her posture. It was no more than her awareness of her own body and of its meaning to him. But for the length of one sentence she stood as a woman, the suggestion of defiance coming only from the faintly stressed spacing of her words.
"And what will it do to you?"
He looked at her, in full understanding, but neither admitting nor denying the confession she wanted to tear from him.
"That is no one's concern but mine," he answered.
It was she who weakened, but realized, while saying it, that this was still more cruel.
"I don't hate you. I've tried to for years, but I never will, no matter what we do, either one of us."
"I know it," he said, his voice low, so that she did not hear the pain, but felt it within herself as if by direct reflection from him.
"Francisco," she cried, in desperate defense of him against herself, "how can you do what you're doing?"
"By the grace of my love for you," said his eyes.
"For the man," said his voice, "who did not perish in your catastrophe, and who will never perish."
She stood silently still for a moment, as if in respectful acknowledgment.
"I wish I could spare you what you're going to go through," he said, the gentleness of his voice saying, "It's not me that you should pity." "But I can't. Every one of us has to travel that road by his own steps. But it's the same road."
"Where does it lead?" He smiled, as if softly closing a door on the questions that he would not answer.
"To Atlantis," he said.
"What?" she asked, startled.
"Don't you remember? The lost city that only the spirits of heroes can enter."
The connection that struck her suddenly had been struggling in her mind since morning, like a dim anxiety she had had no time to identify. She had known it, but she had thought only of his own fate and his personal decision. She had thought of him as acting alone. Now she remembered a wider danger and sensed the vast, undefined shape of the enemy she was facing.
"You're one of them," she said slowly, "aren't you?"
"Of whom?"
"Was it you in Ken Daniger's office?"
He smiled.
"No."
But she noted that he did not ask what she meant.
"Is there? You would know it.
Is there actually a destroyer loose in the world?"
"Of course." "Who is it?"
"You." She shrugged. Her face was growing hard.
"The men who've quit, are they still alive or dead?"
"They're dead, as far as you're concerned. But there's to be a second renaissance in the world. I'll wait for it."
"No."
The sudden violence of her voice was in personal answer to him, to one of the two things he had wanted her to hear in his words.
"No, don't wait for me."
"I'll always wait for you, no matter what we do, either one of us."
The sound they heard was the turning of a key in the lock of the entrance door. The door opened, and Hank Reardon came in. He stopped briefly on the threshold, then walked slowly into the living room, his hand slipping the key into his pocket. She knew that he had seen Francisco's face before he had seen hers. He glanced at her, but his eyes came back to Francisco, as if this were the only face he was now able to see. It was at Francisco's face that she was afraid to look. The effort she made to pull her glance along the curve of a few steps felt as if she were pulling a weight beyond her power. Francisco had risen to his feet, as if in the unhurried, automatic manner of a Danconia trained to the code of courtesy. There was nothing that Reardon could see in his face, but what she saw in it was worse than she had feared.
"What are you doing here?"
asked Reardon, in the tone one would use to address a menial caught in a drawing room.
I see that I have no right to ask you the same question, said Francisco.
She knew what effort was required to achieve the clear, toneless quality of his voice. His eyes kept returning to Reardon's right hand, as if he were still seeing the key between his fingers.
Then answer it, said Reardon.
Hank, any questions you wish to ask should be asked of me, she said. Reardon did not seem to see or hear her.
Answer it, he repeated. There is only one answer which you would have the right to demand, said Francisco. So I will answer you that that is not the reason of my presence here.
There is only one reason for your presence in the house of any woman, said Reardon, and I mean any woman, as far as you're concerned. Do you think that I believe it now? That confession of yours, or anything you ever said to me?
I have given you grounds not to trust me, but none to include Miss Taggart.
Don't tell me that you have no chance here, never had and never will. I know it. But that I should find you here on the first—
Hank, if you wish to accuse me, she began, but Reardon whirled to her.
God, no, Dagny, I don't.
But you shouldn't be seen speaking to him. You shouldn't deal with him in any way.
You don't know him. I do.
He turned to Francisco.
What are you after? Are you hoping to include her among your kind of conquests, or—
No. It was an involuntary cry, and it sounded futile, with its passionate sincerity offered, to be rejected as its only proof.
No. Then are you here on a matter of business? Are you setting a trap as you did for me? What sort of double cross are you preparing for her?
My purpose was not a matter of business.
Then what was it?
If you still care to believe me, I can tell you only that it involved no betrayal of any kind.
Do you think that you may still discuss betrayal in my presence?
I will answer you someday. I cannot answer you now.
You don't like to be reminded of it, do you? You've stayed away from me since, haven't you? You didn't expect to see me here. You didn't want to face me.
But he knew that Francisco was facing him as no one else did these days. He saw the eyes held straight to meet his, the features composed without emotion, without defense or appeal, set to endure whatever was coming. He saw the open, unprotected look of courage. This was the face of the man he had loved, the man who had set him free of guilt, and he found himself fighting against the knowledge that this face still held him, above all else, above his month of impatience for the sight of Dagny.
Why don't you defend yourself if you have nothing to hide? Why are you here? Why were you stunned to see me enter?
Hank, stop it! Dagny's voice was a cry, and she drew back, knowing that violence was the most dangerous element to introduce into this moment. Both men turned to her.
Please, let me be the one to answer, Francisco said quietly.
I told you that I hoped I'd never see him again, said Reardon.
I'm sorry if it has to be here.
It doesn't concern you, but there's something he must be paid for.
If that is your purpose,
Francisco said with effort,
haven't you achieved it already?
What's the matter?
Reardon's face was frozen, his lips barely moving, but his voice had the sound of a chuckle.
Is this your way of asking for mercy?
The instant of silence was Francisco's strain to a greater effort.
Yes. If you wish,
he answered.
Did you grant it when you held my future in your hands?
You are justified in anything you wish to think of me.
But since it doesn't concern Miss Taggart, would you now permit me to leave?
No.
Do you want to evade it, like all those other cowards? Do you want to escape?
I will come anywhere you require, any time you wish, but I would rather
it were not in Miss Taggart's presence.
Why not? I want it to be in her presence, since this is the one place you had no right to come. I have nothing left to protect from you. You've taken more than the looters can ever take. You've destroyed everything you've touched. But here is one thing you're not going to touch.
He knew that the rigid absence of emotion in Francisco's face was the strongest evidence of emotion, the evidence of some abnormal effort at control. He knew that this was torture, and that he, Reardon, was driven blindly by a feeling which resembled a torturer's enjoyment, except that he was now unable to tell whether he was torturing Francisco or himself.
You're worse than the looters, because you betray with full understanding of that which you're betraying. I don't know what form of corruption is your motive, but I want you to learn that there are things beyond your reach, beyond your aspiration or your malice.
You have nothing to fear from me now.
I want you to learn that you are not to think of her, not to look at her, not to approach her. Of all men, it's you who are not to appear in her presence.
He knew that he was driven by a desperate anger at his own feeling for this man, that the feeling still lived, that it was this feeling which he had to outrage and destroy.
Whatever your motive, it's from any contact with you that she has to be protected.
If I gave you my word... He stopped. Reardon chuckled.
I know what they mean, your words, your convictions, your friendship, and your oath by the only woman you ever...
He stopped. They all knew what this meant, in the same instant that Reardon knew it. He made a step toward Francisco. He asked, pointing at Dagny, his voice low and strangely unlike his own voice, as if it neither came from nor were addressed to a living person...
Is this the woman you love?
Francisco closed his eyes.
Don't ask him that!
The cry was Dagny's.
Is this the woman you love?
Francisco answered, looking at her.
Yes.
Reardon's hand rose, swept down, and slapped Francisco's face. The scream came from Dagny. When she could see again, after an instant that felt as if the blow had struck her own cheek, Francisco's hands were the first thing she saw. The heir of the Danconias stood thrown back against a table, clasping the edge behind him, not to support himself, but to stop his own hands. She saw the rigid stillness of his body, a body that was pulled too straight but seemed broken, with the slight unnatural angles of his waistline and shoulders, with his arms held stiff but slanted back. He stood as if the effort not to move were turning the force of his violence against himself, as if the motion he resisted were running through his muscles as a tearing pain. She saw his convulsed fingers struggling to grow fast at the table's edge. She wondered which would break first, the wood of the table or the bones of the man, and she knew that Reardon's life hung in the balance. When her eyes moved up to Francisco's face, she saw no sign of struggle. Only the skin of his temples pulled tight and the planes of his cheeks drawn inward, seeming faintly more hollow than usual. It made his face look naked, pure and young. She felt terror because she was seeing in his eyes the tears which were not there. His eyes were brilliant and dry. He was looking at Reardon, but it was not Reardon that he was seeing. He looked as if he were facing another presence in the room, and as if his glance were saying, "If this is what you demand of me, then even this is yours, yours to accept and mine to endure. There is no more than this in me to offer you, but let me be proud to know that I can offer so much." She saw, with a single artery beating under the skin of his throat, with a froth of pink in the corner of his mouth, the look of an enraptured dedication which was almost a smile, and she knew that she was witnessing Francisco Danconia's greatest achievement. When she felt herself shaking and heard her own voice, it seemed to meet the last echo of her scream in the air of the room. and she realized how brief a moment had passed between. Her voice had the savage sound of rising to deliver a blow, and it was crying to Reardon, "To protect me from him? Long before you ever..." "Don't." Francisco's head jerked to her. The brief snap of his voice held all of his unreleased violence, and she knew it was an order that had to be obeyed. Motionless but for the slow curve of his head, Francisco turned to Reardon. She saw his hands leave the edge of the table and hang relaxed by his sides. It was Reardon that he was now seeing, and there was nothing in Francisco's face except the exhaustion of effort. But Reardon knew suddenly how much this man had loved him. "Within the extent of your knowledge," Francisco said quietly, "you are right." Neither expecting nor permitting an answer, he turned to leave. He bowed to Dagny, inclining his head in a manner that appeared as a simple gesture of leave-taking to Reardon, as a gesture of acceptance to her. Then he left. Reardon stood looking after him, knowing, without context and with absolute certainty, that he would give his life for the power not to have committed the action he had committed. When he turned to Dagny, his face looked drained, open, and faintly attentive, as if he were not questioning her about the words she had cut off, but were waiting for them to come. A shudder of pity ran through her body and ended in the movement of shaking her head. She did not know for which of the two men the pity was intended, but it made her unable to speak, and she shook her head over and over again, as if trying desperately to negate some vast, impersonal suffering that had made them all its victims. "If there's something that must be said, say it." His voice was toneless. The sound she made was half chuckle, half moan. It was not a desire for vengeance, but a desperate sense of justice that drove the cutting bitterness of her voice as she cried, consciously throwing the words at his face, "You wanted to know the name of that other man, the man I slept with, the man who had me first. It was Francisco d'Anconia." She saw the force of the blow by seeing his face swept blank. She knew that if justice was her purpose, she had achieved it, because this slap was worse than the one he had dealt. She felt suddenly calm, knowing that her words had had to be said for the sake of all three of them. The despair of a helpless victim left her. She was not a victim any longer. She was one of the contestants, willing to bear the responsibility of action. She stood facing him, waiting for any answer he would choose to give her, feeling almost as if it were her turn to be subjected to violence. She did not know what form of torture he was enduring, or what he saw being wrecked within him and kept himself the only one to see. There was no sign of pain to give her any warning. He looked as if he were just a man who stood still in the middle of a room, making his consciousness absorb a fact that it refused to absorb. Then she noticed that he did not change his posture, that even his hands hung by his sides with the fingers half bent as they had been for a long time. It seemed to her that she could feel the heavy numbness of the blood stopping in his fingers. And this was the only clue to his suffering she was able to find, but it told her that that which he felt left him no power to feel anything else, not even the existence of his own body. She waited, her pity vanishing and becoming respect. Then she saw his eyes move slowly from her face down the length of her body, and she knew the sort of torture he was now choosing to experience, because it was a glance of a nature he could not hide from her. She knew that he was seeing her as she had been at 17. He was seeing her with the rival he hated. He was seeing them together as they would be now, a sight he could neither endure nor resist. She saw the protection of control dropping from his face, but he did not care whether he let her see his face alive and naked, because there now was nothing to read in it except an unrevealing violence, some part of which resembled hatred. He seized her shoulders, and she felt prepared to accept that he would now kill her or beat her into unconsciousness, and in the moment when she felt certain that he had thought of it,
She felt her body thrown against him and his mouth falling on hers, more brutally than the act of a beating would have permitted. She found herself in terror, twisting her body to resist, and in exultation, twisting her arms around him, holding him, letting her lips bring blood to his, knowing that she had never wanted him as she did in this moment. When he threw her down on the couch, she knew, to the rhythm of the beat of his body, that it was the act of his victory over his rival and of his surrender to him, the act of ownership brought to unendurable violence by the thought of the man whom it was defying, the act of transforming his hatred for the pleasure that man had known into the intensity of his own pleasure, his conquest of that man by means of her body. She felt Francisco's presence through Reardon's mind. She felt as if she were surrendering to both men, to that which she had worshipped in both of them, that which they held in common, that essence of character which had made of her love for each an act of loyalty to both. She knew also that this was his rebellion against the world around them, against its worship of degradation, against the long torment of his wasted days and lightless struggle. This was what he wished to assert, and alone with her in the half-darkness high in space above a city of ruins, to hold as the last of his property. Afterwards they lay still, his face on her shoulder. The reflection of a distant electric sign kept beating in faint flashes on the ceiling above her head. He reached for her hand and slipped her fingers under his face to let his mouth rest against her palm for a moment, so gently that she felt his motive more than his touch. After a while she got up. She reached for a cigarette, lighted it, then held it out to him with a slight, questioning lift of her hand. He nodded, still sitting half-stretched on the couch. She placed the cigarette between his lips and lighted another for herself. She felt a great sense of peace between them, and the intimacy of the unimportant gestures underscored the importance of the things they were not saying to each other. Everything was said, she thought, but knew that it waited to be acknowledged. She saw his eyes move to the entrance door once in a while and remain on it for long moments, as if he were still seeing the man who had left. He said quietly, "He could have beaten me by letting me have the truth any time he wished. Why didn't he?" She shrugged, spreading her hands in a gesture of helpless sadness, because they both knew the answer. She asked, "He did mean a great deal to you, didn't he?" "He does." The two dots of fire at the tips of their cigarettes had moved slowly to the tips of their fingers, with the small glow of an occasional flare and the soft crumbling of ashes as sole movement in the silence, when the doorbell rang. They knew that it was not the man they wished, but could not hope to see return, and she frowned with sudden anger as she went to open the door. It took her a moment to remember that the innocuously courteous figure she saw bowing to her with a standard smile of welcome was the assistant manager of the apartment house. "Good evening, Miss Taggart. We're so glad to see you back. I just came on duty and heard that you had returned and wanted to greet you in person."
"Thank you."
She stood at the door, not moving to admit him.
"I have a letter that came for you about a week ago, Miss Taggart," he said, reaching into his pocket. It looked as if it might be important, but being marked personal, it was obviously not intended to be sent to your office, and besides, they did not know your address either, so not knowing where to forward it, I kept it in our safe, and I thought I'd deliver it to you in person."
The envelope he handed to her was marked, "Registered, Airmail, Special Delivery, Personal." The return address said, "Quentin Daniels, Utah Institute of Technology, Afton, Utah."
"Oh, thank you."
The assistant manager noted that her voice went dropping toward a whisper, the polite disguise for a gasp. He noted that she stood looking down at the sender's name much longer than was necessary, so he repeated his good wishes and departed. She was tearing the envelope open as she walked toward Reardon, and she stopped in the middle of the room to read the letter. It was typewritten on thin paper. He could see the black rectangles of the paragraphs through the transparent sheets, and he could see her face as she read them. He expected it by the time he saw her come to the end.
She leaped to the telephone. He heard the violent whirl of the dial and her voice saying with trembling urgency, "Long distance, please. Operator, get me the Utah Institute of Technology at Afton, Utah." He asked, approaching, "What is it?" She extended the letter, not looking at him, her eyes fixed on the telephone as if she could force it to answer. The letter said, "Dear Miss Taggart, I have fought it out for 3 weeks. I did not want to do it. I know how this will hit you, and I know every argument you could offer me, because I have used them all against myself. But this is to tell you that I am quitting. I cannot work under the terms of Directive 10-289, though not for the reason its perpetrators intended. I know that their abolition of all scientific research does not mean a damn to you or me, and that you would want me to continue. But I have to quit, because I do not wish to succeed any longer. I do not wish to work in a world that regards me as a slave. I do not wish to be of any value to people. If I succeeded in rebuilding the motor, I would not let you place it in their service. I would not take it upon my conscience that anything produced by my mind should be used to bring them comfort. I know that if we succeed, they will be only too eager to expropriate the motor. And for the sake of that prospect, we have to accept the position of criminals, you and I, and live under the threat of being arrested at any moment at their whim. And this is the thing that I cannot take, even were I able to take all the rest, that in order to give them an inestimable benefit, we should be made martyrs to the men who, but for us, could not have conceived of it. I might have forgiven the rest, but when I think of this, I say, may they be damned. I will see them all die of starvation, myself included, rather than forgive them for this or permit it. To tell you the full truth, I want to succeed, to solve the secret of the motor as much as ever. So I shall continue to work on it for my own soul pleasure and for as long as I last. But if I solve it, it will remain my private secret. I will not release it for any commercial use. Therefore, I cannot take your money any longer. Commercialism is supposed to be despicable, so all those people should truly approve of my decision, and I'm tired of helping those who despise me. I don't know how long I will last or what I will do in the future. For the moment, I intend to remain in my job at this institute. But if any of its trustees or receivers should remind me that I am now legally forbidden to cease being a janitor, I will quit. You had given me my greatest chance, and if I am now giving you a painful blow, perhaps I should ask you to forgive me. I think that you love your work as much as I loved mine, so you will know that my decision was not easy to make, but that I had to make it. It is a strange feeling, writing this letter. I do not intend to die, but I am giving up the world, and this feels like the letter of a suicide. So I want to say that of all the people I have known, you are the only person I regret leaving behind. Sincerely yours, Quentin Daniels. When he looked up from the letter, he heard her saying, as he had heard her through the words of the typewritten lines, her voice rising closer to despair each time, "Keep ringing, operator. Please, keep ringing." "What can you tell him?" he asked. "There are no arguments to offer." "I won't have a chance to tell him. He's gone by now. It was a week ago. I'm sure he's gone. They've got him." "Who got him?" "Yes, operator, I'll hold the line. Keep trying." "What would you tell him if he answered?" "I'd beg him to go on taking my money, with no strings attached, no conditions, just so he'll have the means to continue. I'll promise him that if we're still in a looter's world when and if he succeeds, I won't ask him to give me the motor or even to tell me its secret. But if by that time we're free..." She stopped.
"If we're free?"
"All I want from him now is that he doesn't give up and vanish like...
like all those others. I don't want to let them get him. If it's not too late... Oh, God, I don't want them to get him. Yes, operator, keep ringing.
What good will it do us, even if he continues to work?
That's all I'll beg him to do. Just to continue. Maybe we'll never get a chance to use the motor in the future. But I want to know that somewhere in the world there's still a great brain at work on a great attempt, and that we still have a chance at a future. If that motor is abandoned again, then there's nothing but Starnsville ahead of us.
Yes, I know. She held the receiver pressed to her ear, her arm stiff with the effort not to tremble. She waited, and he heard in the silence the futile clicking of the unanswered call.
"He's gone," she said. "They got him. A week is much longer than they need. I don't know how they learn when the time is right, but this..."
She pointed at the letter.
"This was their time, and they wouldn't have missed it."
"Who?"
"The destroyer's agents."
"Are you beginning to think that they really exist?"
"Yes."
"Are you serious?"
"I am. I've met one of them."
"Who?"
"I'll tell you later.
I don't know who their leader is, but I'm going to find out one of these days. I'm going to find out. I'll be damned if I let them..." She broke off on a gasp. He saw the change in her face the moment before he heard the click of a distant receiver being lifted and the sound of a man's voice saying across the wire, "Hello?"
"Daniels, is that you? You're alive. You're still there."
"Why, yes. Is this you, Miss Taggart? What's the matter?"
I thought you were gone."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I just heard the phone ringing. I was out in the back lot gathering carrots."
"Carrots?"
She was laughing with hysterical relief. "I have my own vegetable patch out there. Used to be the Institute's parking lot." "Are you calling from New York, Miss Taggart?"
"Yes. I just received your letter. Just now. I had been away."
"Oh." There was a pause. Then he said quietly, "There's really nothing more to be said about it, Miss Taggart."
"Tell me, are you going away?"
"No."
"You're not planning to go?"
"No. Where?"
"Do you intend to remain at the Institute?"
"Yes."
"For how long? Indefinitely?"
"Yes. As far as I know."
"Has anyone approached you?"
"About what?"
"About leaving."
"No. Who?"
"Listen, Daniels, I won't try to discuss your letter over the phone, but I must speak to you. I'm coming to see you. I'll get there as fast as I can."
"I don't want you to do that, Miss Taggart. I don't want you to go to such an effort when it's useless."
"Give me a chance, won't you? You don't have to promise to change your mind. You don't have to commit yourself to anything. Only to give me a hearing. If I want to come, it's my risk. I'm taking it. There are things I want to say to you. I'm asking you only for the chance to say them."
"You know that I will always give you that chance, Miss Taggart."
"I'm leaving for Utah at once, tonight. But there's one thing I want you to promise me. Will you promise to wait for me? Will you promise to be there when I arrive?"
"Why, of course, Miss Taggart. Unless I die or something happens outside my power. But I don't expect it to happen."
"Unless you die, will you wait for me no matter what happens?"
"Of course."
"Do you give me your word that you'll wait?"
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
"Thank you. Good night."
"Good night, Miss Taggart." She pressed the receiver down and picked it up again in the same sweep of her hand and rapidly dialed the number.
"Eddie, have them hold the Comet for me. Yes, tonight's Comet. Give orders to have my car attached, then come here to my place at once." She glanced at her watch. "It's 8:12. I have an hour to make it. I don't think I'll hold them up too long. I'll talk to you while I pack."
She hung up and turned to Reardon. Tonight, he said.
I have to.
I guess so. Don't you have to go to Colorado anyway?
Yes. I intended to leave tomorrow night. But I think Eddie can manage to take care of my office, and I'd better start now. It takes 3 days,
she remembered.
It will now take 5 days to reach Utah. I have to go by train. There are people I have to see on the line. This can't be delayed either.
How long will you stay in Colorado?
Hard to tell.
Wire me when you get there, will you? If it looks as if it's going to be long, I'll join you there. This was the only expression he could give to the words he had desperately wished to say to her, had waited for, had come here to say, and now wished to pronounce more than ever,